Our guest today is Armin Lack. He is a neuroscientist and is a Sir Henry Dale Fellow at the University of Oxford, studying the neuronal circuits that govern learning and decision making. In particular, his research focuses on the role of dopamine neurons in different types of decision making through a combination of state-of-the-art neuronal circuit tools with novel behavioral methods and computational models. What do you think is the most beautiful aspect about biology? This could be about the brain, about life, or biology in general. So I've started a few episodes with this question before, and I think for students and for people working in academia who are like hyper focused on a problem, it's nice to step back and to just admire the beauty of it all. So what do you find to be the most beautiful thing about biology?
One of the things that I found fascinating is the trade-off between rules and randomness. And so when you are thinking about a biological problem of different scale, we are always trying to find rules. We are always trying to understand what is it exactly that this process is doing, or what are the causes, what are the consequences. But at the same time, there is a degree of randomness in bi every biological process. The type of randomness which effectively, if you really think about it deeply, it allows for evolution, right? And this trade-off to me is fascinating. In science, we are really trying to understand those regularities, those rules. At the same time, at the same time thinking about the randomness. And that's why then kind of, if you think about it more, that's why a statistic comes in, because you kind of you're trying to separate that randomness from rules. But one of the things which I found very exciting and very interesting and fascinating is a trade-off between these two, and how they are regulating the battle between these two is really regulating biological process. This can be at the level of individual cells, at the level of organs, at the level of individuals or society. At every level, we are seeing that trade-off. And I think to me that is fascinating. And that's why I enjoy doing science, because then all our effort is to understand this type of processes, to understand to what extent we can formulate it, to what extent our theories are falling behind, we are falling short in formulating those. And if the theories are falling short, why? Is it because there are other parameters that we are not taking into account, or we are dealing with actually a random process, right?
Yeah, the fact that, I mean, biology is so messy, and there's so much like noise in there, but the fact that it all works out well and like things actually work, you have cells that cooperate and can do things like regeneration and development in
At
such a
different
robust
scale,
way. Yeah.
this trade-off of randomness. And like, if you think about, like, I don't know, if you think about trees, for example, they require a certain recipe of weather and changes in the season in order to grow. But they are faced with this randomness in the weather, right? Sometimes the winter is very warm, or summers could be very cold, and they get through that. They tolerate that, and that I think is fascinating. This process.
Do you think the randomness comes just from the physics of it, or do you think biology is also exploiting that randomness in its favor?
Both. I would say that some of them is not under the control of biology, right? So effectively, if you consider the kind of physical world, right? The composition of the air, the temperature of the air, it's not really what, but biology is adapting to it, and biology is trying to adapt to the randomness which is happening on that level. By virtue of that, it's suffering from it. But it's also taking advantage of it to generate diversity in the biological system, and that diversity is effectively helping later on to deal with new form of randomness, new form of changes in the environment. But we are maybe getting too much to evolution. Maybe we go a little back to maybe neuroscience.
Yeah, maybe on the science, like the doing the science of it, how do you decide or know when what you're observing is something like a random process, or when is it something that you can maybe we should improve our theory on and that we can actually explain this?
Excellent. This is an excellent question. It's a very difficult question. It's effectively the foundation of scientific approach. That when do you break the previous theory and start with a new? How much data do you need to actually show that the previous theory is not working? So let me give you actually concrete example of how I convince myself that the data is showing is something. Assuming that knowing the limitation that we have in terms of amount of that data that we get is not infinite, and as we said, there's a lot of noise and a lot of messy stuff going on. So, but from my perspective in neuroscience, I'm not a big fan of the statistic. So I don't really rely. We use the statistic at the end for writing papers, but I'm not basing my at least the main result, purely based on the statistic. What I would like in our experiment, which often involves animal and various form of recording and modeling, is that we would like to see the core component of the results as much as possible raw data, meaning that you can visualize the differences, and they look visually very, very different. I think that's a great starting point, and you often want to see that in a single experiment, even during the experiment, not like post-processing. That I think that gives me very, very strong confidence that what you are seeing could be real. But that's only the starting point. So I start with that. And that's forming preliminary observation for us, it's forming hypothesis for us, and then we move effectively to larger scale data to start then thinking about formal statistic and formal analysis in order to prove that. But I never learned to do it the other way around. I never went from kind of those big kind of analysis to looking at it the other way around. That has been my approach so far. It might have limitations because there might be processes which are so complex that you might not actually be able to observe them right now in the experiment. So it's not the kind of recipe which works all the time. But in many experiments, you would see signature of that when the experiment works and you see the data and you see the incoming data online, you really can see that these two are really different from each other.
So just the qualitative observation,
That is a fantastic starting point for me.
if they're
In
so
particular,
different that
in particular at the level of individual experiments.
right. And you just know there must be some real biological effect.
There might be, yes, because by virtue of that kind of single experiment that I emphasized, you're kind of implicitly controlling for a lot of things, right? If you see on that same moment on that day in the data which is incoming, by the virtue of that, you have control for the temperature of the like there are a lot of parameters which you can just cancel out, right? It's nothing to do with the temperature of the room. It's nothing to do with that particular kind of preparation that you have. So it kind of it's very powerful a starting point for at least for forming hypotheses.
Let's get into dopamine. We talked about dopamine for a bit in this podcast before, but just briefly, what is dopamine? Why do you find dopamine so special?
Well, dopamine is as we know, it's a molecule released by some cells that by dopamine neurons in the brain. There are multiple reasons that I think it's very, very special. And one of them is that it has profound behavioral effect. Manipulation of the system, like if you release extra dopamine or if you inject dopamine into the brain. But there are many, many papers over the last 5 or 6 decades showing the behavioral manifestation, and they are profound. They are ranging from an animal which is becoming like hyperactive in a way, doing anything it can in order to receive that molecule, all the way. So if you have extra dopamine and you basically see kind of this kind of animals which are like you know, examples of studies from a simulation of this said that animals that keep running or keep poking into hole in order to get more dopamine stimulation, and they forego even food, even water. And all the way from this extreme to the situation that these dopamine cells have died, or they are not existing in the brain, and literally the animal is not even able to move anymore. So the behavioral manifestation are profound, and that's fascinating. And it whatever it does, it does something very, very substantial on the behavior. So, but did you also ask what I think it does?
But what does dopamine have to do with learning? Maybe could you like summarize the reward prediction error hypothesis and some of the key experiments that led to this idea?
So the effectively the dominant theory about what dopamine does is that it is involved in the process of learning. And the way that this is conceptualized and this is studied is that people have been running experiments in which they have been measuring dopamine while animals have been learning simple things about how stimuli or how actions are leading to reward. So imagine a situation that there are two different stimuli, one of them giving reward, one of them not giving reward, and the animal needs to learn that situation, that association. And people have been measuring the activity of these dopamine neurons in this context. And what they found is the following. They found that the activity of this neuron seems to reflect what the animal would expect to receive after seeing a stimulus versus what animal eventually or actually received. So if the animal is, by seeing a stimulus, is expecting that it should give reward and receive that reward exactly as expected, then these neurons are these two identities, these two are equal, so these neurons are not changing their activity. On the other hand, if the animal was seeing a stimulus and expecting to receive the reward, because this stimulus was always giving reward, and then suddenly this reward not received, then the activity of these neurons are inhibited. Or if the reward is more than expectation, the activity of these neurons are larger than normal. So this type of experiment start to slowly show us that what these neurons are doing is effectively calculating the difference between the initial expectation and the ultimate outcome. This turned out to be a very well-defined calculation in the field of reinforcement learning and machine learning. It's called reward prediction error. What I'm describing is a very simplified version of that calculation. But there is suddenly in this crosstalk between scientists in machine learning and neuroscientists, there was this interesting agreement between the activity of these neurons as well as the prediction error signals in the models of reinforcement learning. So this leads to the idea of these neurons are causing reward prediction error. And then multiple other experiments, the data of those experiments show consistency with this hypothesis. For example, if you change the probability of reward, what you expect in the activity of this neuron is exactly what you expect from prediction error of RL model. When you change the timing of the reward, what you see in the activity of this neuron is again consistent with the models of reinforcement learning. So that's the essence of the idea. On top of my recording experiment, There are many more recent manipulation experiments in which you artificially change the activity of these neurons, and you expect to see an effect on the behavior, and that of behavioral manifestation, that behavioral observation, is again consistent with the reward prediction hypothesis.
And how much have we progressed from this hypothesis since it was first formulated? Is it still relevant in currently how neuroscientists think about dopamine?
That's a great question. So this theory has been very influential in terms of promoting several other experiments, many of them showing that this theory works, some of them showing that things are actually more complicated than this, and maybe this theory is not a complete theory. So I can tell you couple of things which are kind of coming more recently, and it makes people thinking about kind of this theory and how it should be revised. Like, one of them is from biological perspective, and from biological perspective, we tend to, in the previous work and the in particular the work that kind of promoted the reward prediction hypothesis, there is a level of simplification in which it's assuming that all these neurons are doing this computation, right? Which is kind of, it's obviously not the case in biology. It's like, and a lot of recent studies have been doing with more refined techniques and more advanced techniques, they have been able to report from more dopamine neurons at the same time in the context of same behavior. And they could see diversity in the activity of these neurons. And this is challenging, at least requiring a revision of this hypothesis in order to incorporate this diversity, right? Because seeing diversity on its own doesn't necessarily mean that the theory is incorrect. Either you can think of it as like it needs to be revised so that this diversity in the activities, including different aspects of this prediction error, one of them on the scale of reward, one of them on the scale of other form of expectation. Or it could that diversity is really pointing towards something which is against that theory. This is still unclear. There are papers advocating that this diversity they can explain by this theory, and there are papers which are opposite on this conclusion. And that is one from the perspective of experimental finding. From perspective of computation, this kind of vanilla type reinforcement learning model are probably too simple, too abstract for biology to implement, right? For example, you can think of one of the complexities is like, you know, how to keep track of time in this type of model, right? A lot of this type of model, they require a specific set of assumption about how the agent, the artificial agent, is keeping track of time, how it gives importance to different time epochs, which is not necessarily what biological agents do. So from computational perspective, these models are evolving to generate effectively various form of kind of flexibility, various and many of those flexibilities are effectively moving away from point process and working with distributions. Like rather than thinking about the absolute value average of reward that the model would take, it's maybe the model can take the distribution of possible rewards that were possibly available in that environment. So the progress, I think the progress are from two perspectives. One is other models and how they incorporate new form of thinking about the computation, and the other is from the biological perspective, by better, less biased form of recording, more refined tools of manipulation. And the field, I think, is standing now on an interesting point. Many papers claiming that this prediction hypothesis is wrong. Many papers doing complicated experiments, complicated theory to actually show that this theory is really the underlying calculation that these neurons are doing.
And in the theory, is it just about learning about rewards, or is it learning about the environment in general? Because rewards is also very hard to actually define, and you can have something might seem like a reward now, but then actually it turns out really badly, or something doesn't feel like it's good, but that turned like in the long term it's actually a reward. Like how would the theory account for these nuances?
No, that's so the core of the theory, at least it doesn't. The core of the theory is very simple. It defines reward as a scalar variable, and the agent's task is really to maximize that reward. So it doesn't assume all those things that you are mentioning, that if the reward is like losing its value, or if they are state dependent, like the value of the reward is state dependent, as you were mentioning. So it doesn't, the core of that, the initial kind of vanilla form of the theory doesn't. But the more advanced version of this model are really incorporating all those things. They incorporate ways that the agents are actually learning about the structure of the environment. Rather than explicitly maximizing reward, they even forego reward in order to learn the structure of the environment. They work with the type of reward which are not necessarily in that scalar value. They can change a state-dependent manner. When it comes to connecting this newer form of model, or more advanced form of model, the literature, the biological literature, goes beyond dopamine. So you can, for example, think about the prediction, or it does, it can be about, like, not about the reward at all, but about whether I was expecting to see any stimulus and I see it or not, right? So it's kind of, prediction error in the space of expectation of whether I see the stimulus, whether I was expecting to see that stimulus without any reward, right? So in this kind of, those type of theories, the connection to biology actually goes beyond the dopamine activity. It goes to various regions of the brain. There are several studies claiming that if you go to higher level, for example, if there's a visual stimuli, higher level cortical areas which are processing visual information, what they do is effectively is calculate to what extent this visual stimulus was expected. You can call it effectively a stimulus prediction error if you want to simplify it.
I guess we'll get back to your thoughts on, like reconciling all these different functions of dopamine, but you've worked a lot on decision making. So let me ask, what is economic decision making? What is perceptual decision making? Are they fundamentally different in terms of the algorithms involved in the decision making process, or do you see them as basically the same thing, but in different brain areas?
Excellent. It's the so the let's just start with the definition, at least the kind of the way that we define these two types of decision making in the literature. Economic decision making is the process in which we decide between options based on how we feel subjectively about them. So there is really no correct answer. If I go to a restaurant and I order pizza over steak or fish over steak, this is my preference. It's not wrong. It's not right. It's reflecting my subjective preference about options which are available to me. And this form of decision making, what we call them, are economic decision making. Of course, there are a lot of parameters, how costly those foods are, how hungry I am, which defines my decision. But it's ultimately working on my subjective valuation of the options around. And perceptual decision making is different. This is about detecting or discriminating stimuli in the environment, sensory stimuli in the environment. So there is often a correct answer. There is either if there is a flash of light on the screen, or if I hear, if there is a sound in the environment, there is either a sound or there is no sound. So it's less of a subjective process, but more like reporting, detecting, or discriminating stimuli which are immediately available in the immediate environment. So that's how we have been thinking in terms of the definition. whether they are same or not. So this is actually this is actually the one of the points that kind of I did some work in order to actually think about these two processes and to what extent they are similar or separate from each other. So many people in the field either work on one or the other. So you basically, as a PhD student or a postdoc, you get to a lab, they work on value-based decision-making, economic decision-making, or perceptual decision-making, and then you kind of move on. They have quite segregated literature, and there's very little crosstalk between the literature on these two. Even the brain regions that they have been studied in one, they are less studied in the other one and other way around. I was fortunate enough to kind of go between economic value labs and sensory or perceptual task lab. And I was kind of a bit surprised that kind of the same thing that people in the economic lab are saying, you could also kind of see kind of analogy of that in the same in the perceptual decision literature or in the lab. But there was very little connection between these two, and that's kind of one of the fundamental kind of project that, with which I started my lab. So we basically started with experiments in which, in the same animal, we wanted to study both perceptual decision making and value based decision making, or having a behavioral type of platform which allows us to study the trade off between these two types of decision making. And we could come up with simple behavioral paradigms in mice as well as other animals, which can allow us to investigate this type of decision making process and to bring them into kind of one experiment. The other thing that we have done on that front is effectively to think about, to bring ideas of reward prediction error, which is really in economic decision making, bring it and reframe it into perceptual decision making, and to see to what extent the dopaminergic activity in the context of perceptual decision making can also reflect prediction error. Saying that because almost exclusively the whole literature connecting dopamine and reward prediction error, the type of task that they have been using is economic decision-making tasks. So what we have done in the lab as well as before is to record from this neuron in the context of perceptual decision tasks, when there are the stimuli are coming on the screen, trying to think computationally how we can think about prediction error in the context of perceptual decisions, and to see to what extent the dopaminergic activity is reflecting that. So I think that these processes have many similarities in terms of the circuit computing what reward I would expect to get from what I'm seeing, from what I'm sensing, and the action that I have in preparation. Although there might be brain regions which are more involved in one than the other, but I think our work on the dopamine system shows quite a huge overlap between the two form of tasks. Like, in a way, you can really titrate the strength of the stimulus and the strength of the value of the reward, and you can get rather indistinguishable responses in dopaminergic activity. Like, if I see a stimulus very well, but the reward is very small, the dopamine activity responses to that stimulus are quite large and it's quite similar to stimulus which is not very seen very well, but it really receives a large reward. So you see the trade-off between the two.
I guess so. It's really this, your sense is that it's really the same functional circuits and same fundamental algorithm underlying both processes.
To some extent, yes. At the level of brain regions which are converging a lot of inputs, let's say dopaminergic neurons or neurons in the frontal cortex and so on and so forth, there is a huge degree of representational overlap. So same set of cells effectively would respond regardless of the task, whether it be a sensory task, a perceptual task, or economic task. But also at the same time, I think that the would be many many brain regions which have more roles in one than the other. Like, if I if I lesion the primary visual area, I can't do sensory tasks, but I still would be able to go to the restaurant and make a choice on the menu.
Right. So could you go into more detail into what role does dopamine actually play in these decision-making processes?
So the simple way of thinking about it is going back to the idea of what this neuron would do is signal the difference between the expectation and the reward that I receive, right? So what can you do with that signal in the context of this type of decision? The immediate thing that we can do with this signal is effectively to use that signal in order to make a better decision in the future. So if I make a decision, and dopamine neurons are at the time of the outcome, they are silent. That basically means that, okay, I made a decision. I expected what I received what I was expecting. Probably learning is completed. I don't need to learn anymore, right? So I can safely make the same choice. It didn't violate my expectation. I assumed that my expectation was okay. It was formed based on maximizing reward. So no learning needed. Go back to the same restaurant, get the same pizza. It's a good pizza. But if I have a situation that by having that by that pizza coming in, I have it and I have a positive prediction error in dopamine activity, meaning that I was not expecting such an amazing food, then this is a situation that learning that we can use that signal in order to promote learning next time. What I should do with this signal is to change the circuit so that next time if I'm in that restaurant, I'm making sure that I order the same thing because that was much better than my expectation. So this is how this signal would work in the context of the decision making. But you realize that this is really having the flavor of learning, because what I say is that it has basically had nothing to do with the current decision. All I can do with this signal is to use it for the future behavior, right? So this view is really coming from kind of, you know, this neuron being important in the process of learning. But there are also studies which are challenging this slightly, and they will say that dopamine on that same decision, it might motivate and invigorate that decision. Like not necessarily a good example, but if the decision is about like moving quickly to the left or to the right in order to catch a ball in the tennis, maybe. Dopaminergic activity is important to invigorate those actions. And of course the challenge is to what extent is dopaminergic activity is about just invigorating those actions versus learning for the future behavior. So you can see the dual role, at least in the flavor of the dual role of this molecule on invigorating current behavior versus shaping the future behavior. Whether these two can coexist in a circuit, I think they can. There is not one dopamine cell in the brain. There are thousands and thousands of them, so they can be specialized based on the role in learning versus the more the role in the invigoration of action and in motivation.
Yeah, we did have Kent Berridge on this podcast almost a year back, and we spoke to him about, you know, his incentive salience theory of dopamine, which is the idea that dopamine is the craving signals that makes cues for rewards salient. And essentially he formulated the big question as like, does dopamine actually mediate the learning mechanism, or does it cause the want for the learned reward? And so your sense in this debate is that both of them could coexist in the same circuit?
Yes, not necessarily in the same circuit, but I think the complexity of the circuit allows for multiple functions. So it is definitely the case that this signal will cause learning. Like if we change the activity of this neuron next time animal is seeing the same stimulus, it changes the behavior. So that I would call that learning. That's effectively a modification of behavior in the future based on what has happened in the past. can be defined as learning. But at the same time, whether it has also effect on the immediate behavior, whether it has the to what extent it complies with Kent Bridges' theory. My view at the moment is that this is my current view, is that there are different dopaminergic neurons. They project to different regions in the striatum or to the cortex, and they have qualitatively different type of responses. And these responses and this release of dopamine can be used to modify behavior in different ways. Some of them compatible with Ken Bridges' theory, and the others compatible with the reinforcement learning theories. We have done some experiments on this in the lab, which is pointing to, again, this form of diversity. For example, we had this task in which very simple visual stimuli appearing on the screen, and we were recording dopamine signals in different regions of the striatum, dorsal striatum, ventral striatum, and in the same animal, we saw qualitatively different signals, like one of them doing one thing, the other one is doing another thing. This, well, at least this what it shows us is that they might do, in the core, they might do the same computation, the manifestation is different, but they definitely have different impact on downstream structure. There are events that causes activity in one of them, but not the other. So the downstream, which is listening, is cells in the striatum or the frontal cortex, which are listening, they basically get these pulses of dopamine in different situations. And assuming that the effect of that molecule on the downstream structure is to cause plasticity, it would mediate different aspects of behavior. Then different dopaminergic signal would mediate that different aspect of behavior.
Maybe we can like reconcile like these different functions of dopamine by considering like different spatial temporal and context of where and when you see the dopamine signaling.
Different spatial temporal and different context.
Different like anatomical circuits and different timing and context.
Yeah. So I think I'm starting to believe a lot in the circuit side. And the reason for that is that So these cells effectively have different inputs, right? Some of them have more inputs from some part of the brain, the others have different inputs from other parts of the brain. And if they have different inputs, right, they end up effectively integrating different information, and they end up effectively firing in response to different things, right? So even in the same context, in the same spatial-temporal scale of behavior, at least, on the same context, you still have this diversity, and I think the reason for this diversity is simply because they have the different dopamine neurons have different inputs, and they get information from different regions of the brain. One thing which is then important is to say that, okay, do they do the same calculation, prediction error using different inputs, or is it not the case? And I don't think we know that answer. We have done some modeling work recently, one of the students in the lab, which is kind of suggesting that diversity itself, you can still explain it if you just form predictions based on different inputs. But it's still ongoing.
And maybe back to economic decision making. So when you mentioned it's like subjective value when we're picking between different options. And so to do that computation, you would need to have a measure of value for both or whatever, how many options, and then be able to compare them. Does dopamine have a representation of the subjective value, or is it just taking that as input and calculating a prediction error?
Great. No, that's a great question. So the signals, when we were manipulating these other experiments that I was doing, in which we're manipulating the subjective value of the stimuli in the context of animals, had like different type flavor of reward, different magnitude of reward, or combination of between the two. And what we observe in those experiments is that the activity of this neuron is scaled by subjective value in form of, again, in form of prediction error, but on the scale of subjective value. So what I'm receiving, if I feel that it is much better than what I was expecting, then these neurons were positively surprised and active. So I think the true representation in this, at least in the subset of neurons which code this, is effectively really coding prediction error on the scale of utility and the scale of subjective utility that I assign to that option. Whether this is inherited from the rest of the brain or they are calculated, like the values are calculated in dopamine activity, I think they are inherited from the rest of the brain. The dopamine signal, as I was mentioning before, they have a huge set of even monosynaptic, like, you know, there are like more than 20 brain regions which are directly projecting to these neurons. Many of them are high level brain regions such as frontal cortex and so on and so forth. So information which comes in already is a process information. We already know that at the level of this input, there's a representation of utility or subjective value, let's say in the frontal cortex. So my sense is that these signals are coming in, and what dopamine does is then compare them with the ultimate outcome.
I mean, so to compare different outcomes, I mean, we're talking about actually computing a value like maybe the dopamine signal scaling with the utility of a choice. But do you think that it's necessary that brains must be computing value when making value-based decisions? So, you know, when we decide on preferences, there could be a lot of other alternative heuristics that we could use that doesn't actually require computing a scalar value.
I agree. Yes, and that's a great, great question, and you can even think about it like, as you say, many simple heuristics would guide decisions. This is for sure. So whether we are really calculating value or so, what we can say is that I think from the perspective of kind of more conservative perspective is that the behavioral manifestation, when you are measuring the behavioral manifestation of these choices, are as if the subject has been calculating value, right? You can basically expose people to different scenarios in which they are, like, you know, making like hypothetical gambling game between different values, different probabilities, different time to reward. So, and if you aggregate those data, and then you can effectively test a lot of kind of axioms which are coming from economy, like a simple one would be transitivity and so on and so forth. So then what behavioral economists would say is that, okay, if the subject is following all those axioms and is satisfying all those axioms, what we can say is that the behavior is as if this agent has been calculating value, right? You're absolutely right that many, you might get the same type of decision outcome if the values are not calculated, going with values type of heuristic. But I think there would be possibilities to actually, at least at the level of behavioral level, to separate these two from each other. Because I'm not 100% sure about this, but whether it's possible to design behavioral tests which separate these two, it would be actually a very, very interesting thing to do.
Mm. We've spoken a lot about, you know, studying the function of dopamine circuits, but experimentally, how do you actually do that? What are the techniques involved, and what are the limitations of different experimental approaches?
We also have a set of tools for measuring the activity of dopamine neurons. Each of them have advantages and each of them have limitations. So you can think about what are the things that we need. We need the signals to be temporally very precise. to be especially very precise. So we know exactly when they go up and down, and we know exactly where in the brain they go up and down. And we also ideally want to make sure that it is actually dopamine molecule. So it's not very trivial to actually say that what we measured was this dopamine molecule, but not other similar molecule, right? So we need this kind of a spatial resolution, temporal resolution, and a specificity in case of dopamine. We don't have any tool really to have all of them at the same time. We have all of our tools are about usually having two out of three. For example, if you think about electrophysiology, it's fast. You can have a good temporal resolution. You can have a decent spatial resolution, you know, where the electrode is in the brain. But it's very hard to say that the signal is really dopamine. It can be another thing. It can be a dopamine neuron. It can be another cell which is just adjacent to dopamine neuron. We have other tools which are using genetic or the combination of optics and genetics. The major advantage here is that by virtue of using genetics, we can reach a specificity. We can be sure, by using genetic tricks, we can be sure that what we are measuring is really specifically coming from dopamine neurons. At the same time, these tools have good spatial resolution, but they have quite poor temporal resolution. So you see the trade-off here. We don't have a tool which is ticking all boxes, but then that's why we're using a combination of all of them in order to address the limitation of each tool. One of the very new advances that we have in terms of tool are type of kind of sensors which allow us to actually measure the release of this molecule. So before we have been looking a lot into the activity of the cell itself. Activity of the cell, always we assume, it's an okay assumption that always the activity of the cell is causing the release of dopamine, but it's not 100% one-to-one relationship between these two. So we have new tools, we have new optical sensors, which allow us to measure the release. That has opened up a lot of kind of avenues for us. Like, do we see the same form of computation at the level of release of this molecule? With this, we can go to brain region. We can directly measure the release. We don't need to stay close to the cell bodies. We can go all the way where the axons of these cells are going and put our optical probe there and measure the release in those regions. It has opened up a lot of new avenues and possibilities for us.
Yeah. And how are computational models used in your work, and what type of understanding do they provide?
Fantastic. So we are using computational models quite a bit. And we effectively perform different forms of computational modeling with different aims. One of them is about understanding the behavior. And what do I mean by understanding the behavior? So the working with animals, they are not verbal. They don't tell us really what they think about this choice. What did they think when they made this choice versus the other choice? So we end up having very sparse form of data. We basically, like, all the animal is telling us is left versus right. So the way it's like a binary choice that it does, right? We use computational models in order to model the behavior. And because we know the variables which are inside the model, now if the model works against the behavior very nicely, this gives us a very interesting set of internal variables, which we can test against neural activity. For example, we were talking about prediction, right? An animal would never tell you what was the prediction. All we hear from the animal is like left versus right. But with these computational tricks, we can actually have quite a good accuracy on what was that animal predicting when making that choice. This, of course, relies on kind of, you know, having those models and fitting that model on the behavior, so that the behavior of the animal and the model are generating the same binary choices. And we could, based on this similarity, we say that, okay, they probably have the same internal computation. One of those would be prediction about what reward I would get. This is one form of computational modeling that we do. The other form of computational modeling that we do is a thing slightly away from behavior. It uses the component of circuit connectivity in order to establish the computation that neurons are performing. And so we take advantage of what we know from anatomy, and you can consider that we basically have models which are, they have arrows that this place is projecting to this place. They have this type of neuron and that type of neuron, but you can effectively consider it as a type of neural network type model with the connectivity which is coming from what we know from circuit. And we use those in order to compare those artificial type models with the activity of neurons that we're recording in the experiment.
And what does it mean for you to have a circuit level understanding of the neuronal mechanisms underlying learning and decision making? So what level of explanation would you be satisfied with?
Difficult question. And the more years passes, as the time passes, that this is changing for me. So there is, in a way, a never ending. So, you know, what is it? At a circuit level, it's like, you know, do you want to go to the specific cells and do you want to know the machinery inside those cells?
The circuit level understanding that we want to have, effectively, what we want to have is to understand at the level of individual cells or at the level of population of cells, the calculation that these cells are doing. What I would like ideally to achieve is to reveal calculations which are informative in constraining models and in constraining computational. What do I mean by that? So if I say that, you know, imagine that I do an experiment, beautiful experiment, difficult experiment, and the conclusion is that, oh, these neurons are responding to actions, these neurons are responding to reward, these neurons are responding to stimuli. This is cool, but it doesn't constrain any model, right? It doesn't, that's like, you know, the fact that these neurons responded to action but not to the stimulus is really very little insight into the like, you know, can I build a machine based on that information? No. What I would like to achieve is to get to the level of computation at the level of this individual neurons or population, which allows us to take this computation and ideally build machine or try to build machine based on those. That's why one of the reasons I love the dopamine, because it has the essence of that, this idea that you basically take this calculation, translate it to machines, and you get inspiration from machines, you study the circuit.
That's very cool. Just a few more personal questions before we end.
Yeah.
What is your favorite part about doing science?
What's my favorite part? My favorite part, I like everything about science, but what I really like about science is discussing data, discussing theories, discussing experimental design with other people. So I think that the way that, at least the way that my brain works, is that when, like, you know, thinking when discussing is, to me, is a very kind of important part of my scientific job, and I spend the majority of my time discussing it with the students in the lab, postdocs in the lab, about the data. What does that mean? What are the compounds? What are the issues? How can we refine that? What's that's one part which I really enjoy. It's just this kind of, in a way, it's kind of very nice, stimulating, challenging kind of intellectual discussion, which I really like. The other
part which I really like about the science, and I am still trying to keep up with that, is effectively just doing the experiment. It's a lot of fun. Just going, being on the rig and doing experiment for me is really a lot of fun. And working with animals as well, is a lot of fun.
And you did your PhD with Wolfram Scholl, so obviously it's like founding figure in the reward prediction error hypothesis. What was it like working with him? What was one thing that you learned from him about doing science? And have your research, do you still have similar ideas with him about the function of dopamine?
Yeah, so that was great working with him. I think, in fact, like I moved to work with him from Long Island in New York, and there I was a research assistant. I moved to Cambridge in the UK for my PhD. One other thing, which I, a couple of things I really learned from him. One was the level of engagement and, scientific engagement and that he had, which really inspired me and influenced me. And the other was, I really came face to face with what it really takes to do like high impact, important research. Like what it is, like, because thousands of labs are around. Some of them are doing more fundamental, more kind of impactful work. And in the first few months in his lab, I basically came to the understanding of what it takes, and to what extent you need to really be involved and enjoy it and like feel it, like, it's like full on in order to be able to do this type of high impact science. So that was this together with the level of kind of energy and the engagement that he had was really informative for me, and I learned a lot. And so those are the two things. The experiment that we do, some of them on dopamine system, we try to better understand the circuit based on the work that he has done, based on the work that other people have done. As I said, some of the experiment, some of the result that we are seeing now in terms of diversity of the activity, are hard to explain only based on vanilla, based on simple form of reward prediction or hypothesis. So we are trying to expand on the theoretical side to better understand to what extent these computations are, to what extent they reflect the theory or departures from that theory. So that's my answer to that.
That's great. One final question. What advice do you have for young scientists?
What advice do I have? I can give some practical advice of like, learn to code, but I think many people know that people are getting training those days on reading, on learning to code, and going to meetings and stuff. I think that is that I can give those. But if I want to give another type of advice, I would say that I think it's important to enjoy this work, because it's a lot about the process rather than the outcome. It can get difficult sometimes at the level of outcome in publication and going through the review process, and it can get slow and quite tricky. But the joy is throughout the day by day doing the science, which I think people, including myself, we should do more and more. I think this is quite important, because if you don't enjoy, then we don't think better about it. We don't challenge ourselves with the thoughts. We don't do a better analysis. We don't do a better experiment. So that, I think, is the drive, and that's the key to take it forward.
Yeah, academia is a very long journey. Armin, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Fantastic. I hope that this was useful. That was really cool. That was awesome question that you had. I hope that I really enjoyed discussing, and I hope that this is going to be of use for the podcast.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it as well, and good luck with your research.
Good luck to you as well.